Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Fasting for Lent. Today is Ash Wednesday, and we take a look at Operation Rice Bowl, the annual Lenten initiative of Catholic Relief Services, and how it ties in with Pope Benedict's message for Lent this year. Lenten Reflections. Jesuit father and author Jerry O'Collins and Dominican father Robert Ombres reflect on the significance of the Ash Wednesday liturgy. And Dying with Dignity, we discover why it's time to banish that image of the hospice as a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony.
But first, we bring you news of the new Archbishop of New York. Monsignor Timothy Dolan was appointed by Pope Benedict earlier this week. He's a familiar voice to some of our listeners here on Vatican Radio, who will remember his weekly series, Think of It This Way. Charles Collins takes us to the celebrations in New York.
Archbishop Timothy Dolan joined Cardinal Edward Egan for Mass on Monday morning. Cardinal Egan, who is retiring after nearly 9 years of service to the Archdiocese, told the congregants that the Archdiocese is being put into good hands.
Archbishop Dolan has come here to New York and will be installed as the shepherd of this Archdiocese to strengthen us in our faith, to lead us in prayer, and to guide us in the works of justice and compassion and peace.
At a press conference later Monday, Archbishop Dolan spoke for the first time to the people of New York.
I just need to learn, and the Cardinal's already started the tutoring, and a lot of reading, a lot of listening, a lot of meeting people. You can't go wrong with just listening to your priests and your people. It sounds pretty much now like the greatest mission I have is to continue the excellent, the vitality and the growth and the progress of the Archdiocese in New York.
The head of the Archdiocese press office, Joseph Zwilling, says New York will be pleased with the choice.
I think, first of all, that he's a real churchman, and he's given his life to the service of the church, whether in forming priests, whether in being an auxiliary bishop, a parish priest, head of his own diocese. He's been a real man of the church, and I think they're going to see that come through. I think they're also going to find he's got a very warm personality, and I think people will like him.
Archbishop Dolan served as rector of the Pontifical North American College in Rome from 1994 until 2001. He went to the Archdiocese of St. Louis as an auxiliary bishop in June 2001 and was appointed Archbishop of Milwaukee a year later. He will be installed as Archbishop of New York on April 15th, Easter Wednesday. I'm Charles Collins.
Well, from New York, we return here to Rome, where Pope Benedict was due Wednesday to preside the traditional Ash Wednesday liturgy and the blessing and imposition of the ashes in the Basilica of Santa Sabina on Rome's Aventine Hill. Back now to Susie Hodges.
Lent is the 40-day season of penance that precedes Easter. And in his Lenten message this year, Pope Benedict focuses specifically on the value and meaning of fasting. The Pope says fasting from food and detaching oneself from material goods during Lent help believers open their hearts to God and their hands to the poor. He said, by fasting in solidarity with the poor, we make a statement that our brother or sister in need is not a stranger. And it was precisely this attitude of the Good Samaritan that was at the heart of an address by the executive director of the World Food Programme, Josette Sheeran, who this year helped present the Pope's Lenten message in the Vatican. Sheeran said, "Serving the hungry is a moral call that unites people of all faiths."
I would like to assure each and every person that when it comes to hunger, they can make a difference. Feeding the hungry is a profound act of love and restores dignity to a mother or father who cannot provide for a starving child. This is a critical moment. While all families must take some sacrifices during these economic hard times, for the poorest of the poor, this means going without meals for a day or two or three. If you can imagine, if you're living on less than $1 a day and the cost of commodities have doubled or your income gets cut, you're cutting out the basic nutrition for your children and family. Today, a child dies every 6 seconds from hunger. The question is there anything that can be done to alleviate the humiliation, pain, and injustice of hunger? Are there solutions that help people break the cycle of hunger for themselves, once and for all? The answer overwhelmingly is yes.
That was Josette Sheeran, Executive Director of the World Food Programme. The WFP is a UN agency, but it relies heavily on Catholic charities and other faith-based organisations to help distribute food aid around the world. One of those Catholic charities in the forefront of the fight against hunger and poverty is Catholic Relief Services, or CRS, based in the USA. Every year during Lent, CRS organises Operation Rice Bowl, an initiative whereby millions of Catholics are encouraged to fast and make a small sacrifice and donate the money they are saving to programs that help to alleviate hunger. Beth Martin is in charge of Operation Rice Bowl, and she says how pleased they were with the choice of fasting as the special focus for this year's papal Lenten message.
We were very excited to read the Pope's Lenten message this year because it really kind of highlights the heart of the Operation Rice Bowl program, which encourages people to fast and set aside what they save from their sacrifices and give it to those in need around the world.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how exactly Operation Rice Bowl works and how many people take part in it?
Sure. Operation Rice Bowl started back in 1975, and it was a program to assist people suffering from the drought in Africa. Each week, families prepare simple meals and donate what they save from their regular meals to assist their brothers and sisters overseas. And so families, during the 40 days of Lent, take time to pray for their neighbors overseas. They fast through eating these simple meals. They learn about the work that Catholic Relief Services does on their behalf around the world to help people suffering from hunger and poverty, and they give their sacrifices to assist those in need.
So you're saying they donate the money that they would have spent on a perhaps more lavish meal to support Catholic Relief Services?
Exactly, yes.
Are you worried that this year donations may be down due to the global financial crisis and credit crunch, which of course is, you know, causing massive hardship, layoffs of many jobs, people losing their homes because they can't keep up with their mortgage?
Definitely. And we are very sensitive to the fact that the global economic crisis is impacting people in every country in the world, including here in the United States. What we're telling people who participate in Rice Bowl is that we really do appreciate the gifts that they give, and the poor around the world are being impacted even more so than we are here in the United States. So we're hoping that people will still be able to take part in this traditional Lenten practices of fasting and giving alms and give what they can to support those who might be even more impacted around the world.
And how much money was raised last year through Operation Rice Bowl, and was that a fairly typical amount?
Yes, last year was fairly typical. Annually, we raise about $7 million a year that goes to Catholic Relief Services, and this money goes to fund our food security projects in 40 countries around the world, projects in agriculture, water and sanitation, microfinance projects, mother and child health, and education programs. And actually, the $7 million represents 75% of the collection for Operation Rice Bowl, and the remaining 25% stays in local dioceses here in the United States to alleviate hunger and poverty programs locally. So we think that this local and global connection really enables us to live out our Catholic call to help those in need all around the world, either, even in our own communities as well as in communities where we'll never visit. So we're hoping that the 25% will be of use to people here in the United States who are suffering from the economic downturn as well.
You described how 75% of the money raised is used abroad and 25% in the U.S. Can you give us, or rather describe for us, some concrete examples of projects in a certain country and how the money is actually used there?
Sure. Like I said, we fund projects in 40 countries around the world, and in the Operation Rice Bowl materials, there's actually stories from people in those countries who receive funds through this program. For instance, this year we're featuring a project in Egypt where it's a microfinance project where women receive small loans so that they can start small businesses and then enable them to earn money to support their families. So there's a story about a woman named Amal who has a bakery that she is able to earn money to buy enough food for her own children and to send them to school and provide them for all the needs that they have. We also are featuring a story from a farmer in the Philippines who is benefiting from training and different projects that help him have a better idea about sustainable agriculture so that he can grow more on his farm and make more money from his farming.
So we're talking here about projects that can really transform people's lives.
Yes, that is the goal of Catholic Relief Services and our work around the world is to really help people take action to make a difference in their own lives. So we really want to help them gain skills and opportunities so that they can provide a better livelihood for themselves and their families.
And do you ever get any kind of direct feedback from the recipients of this aid, or do you hear about it more from your local staff on the ground?
Well, actually, in the Operation Rice Bowl materials, we do interview the beneficiaries, so the people who are participating in this project, and they do give us feedback about how these are really life-changing opportunities for them once they receive the training or the assistance to help them turn their lives around, and it really just very grateful for the work that Catholic Relief Services does on behalf of the Catholic community here in the United States.
Now, I imagine that Catholic schools and parishes throughout the U.S. Are very much actively involved in the Operation Rice Bowl initiative. I mean, do you have any idea of numbers and, you know, how active they are?
Yes, we do. Currently, we have about 8.2 million Catholics here in the United States and about 12,000 parishes and schools all across the United States and in every state of the nation who are participating in Rice Bowl. And it's really exciting because Operation Rice Bowl has been a program since 1975, and a lot of communities consider it to be their Lenten tradition. So people look forward to it every year and really are excited about learning about how what they can do during Lent can make a big difference in the lives of people that they'll never meet around the world.
Okay. And when you talk to people in the U.S. who've taken part in this initiative, what do they tell you about what it means for them, its significance for them, or how it's helped them become a better person?
Yes, I think people really do like to participate in Operation Rice Bowl, especially because they can read the stories from people overseas who are benefiting firsthand from this. And I think it makes a difference. People learn about countries where they might never have even heard of the country before, and they really see that the small amounts that they're giving during Lent add up and really can make a difference in the lives of their brothers and sisters overseas. So I think that's really a great feeling that people have in participating in this program, that it's coming together, we can really make a big difference in problems that our world faces.
I was speaking there to Beth Martin of Catholic Relief Services in the U.S. Jesuit Father Jerry O'Collins is the former professor of theology at the Pontifical Gregorian University and author or co-author of more than 40 books,
his latest being called Jesus Our Redeemer. He explains why we are all Ash Wednesday people.
Years ago, I met a man who told me that he knew only one thing about Christians. It was something two of his friends at work did once a year. They both go off together at lunch hour, he told me. And when they come back, they have a little ash on their foreheads. What his friends did once a year was to go into a church on Ash Wednesday and receive the ashes. A priest will sprinkle a little ash on their foreheads and say the words, "Remember, you are dust, and unto dust you will return." Ash on our foreheads shows us what we are, people of dust and destined to die. Dust stands for death and for things breaking up. Dust is not like the beautiful rocks we can dig up in the mountains or the lovely seashells we find along the shore. One speck of dust is just like another. It doesn't belong anywhere. It's barely visible and noticeable. In a way, we're all like that, mortal human beings heading towards death. Our lives can even seem pointless and meaningless, like dust about to be blown away. An Arab friend once said to me, "Our lives begin as a drop of seed sown in desire and end as a handful of dust." Thinking that way about the start of life is perhaps a good reminder of how fragile we really are. Why am I here at all? My mother and father need never have met. Circumstances could so easily have been different and never brought them together. 6 years into their marriage, without going into the biological details, another human being could have emerged to take a place in the world. But that new person would not have been me. I need never have existed. We're all Ash Wednesday people. We exist between a drop of seed sown in desire and our end, when we will become a handful of dust. Probably this is the last thing any of us want to be told on a fine Sunday evening. I can just hear my sister-in-law saying, "Jerry, would you please be cheerful and say something positive?" Now, I'm all for being positive. God is extremely cheerful and very positive too. But God is also realistic. We too must be realistic and come to terms with what we are. Death is as important as birth. But we're not just little piles of dust to be blown away finally on the wind. We are much, much more than that, because God loves each one of us and loves us with an infinite and faithful love.
That was Jesuit Father Jerry O'Collins. And now let's hear another reflection on the symbolism of the Ash Wednesday liturgy from Dominican Father Robert Ombres.
Liturgy means many things. Part of its meaning and its power is it's a drama that we act out in very significant, striking ways, beliefs that normally remain hidden in our lives. And Ash Wednesday, of course, is one of the most dramatic acting out of some of our beliefs. The ashes, the words of a priest in saying, "Remember, you are dust, to dust you will return," make us see in a literal way, make us put us in touch, literally, with the meaning of a feast and of our lives, which are fragile, mortal, but under grace can be redeemed and preserved forever. And what we do on Ash Wednesday in this dramatic way of receiving the ashes, of begging forgiveness and of beginning acts of penance, we act out most intensely for one day what we'll then carry out for 40 days and, of course, all the year round. But we need strong reminders every year of what ought to be our normal Christian way of life. Traditionally, there have been, from the Bible, three elements to Lent, and therefore to Ash Wednesday: prayer, almsgiving, and fasting. All three have to go together. Each in isolation doesn't make as much sense, Christian sense, as it does with the others. And what they do, there are ways of asking, how do I stand with God? Prayer. How do I relate to my neighbour, particularly when he or she is in need? Almsgiving. And how do I regard myself? Fasting. So these are three ways of asking questions of ourselves, but not just in the head, but involving all of us in prayer, giving to the poor, and fasting.
That was Dominican Father Robert Ombres. For most people, the word hospice is associated with pain and suffering, and above all, death. Many of us would not even relish the idea of stepping inside a place that cares for the terminally ill, as few like to dwell too closely on the uncomfortable truth of our own mortality. But as I've been finding out, a hospice nowadays is far from being a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony.
This is a place of much love and much laughter and much hope and much faith, and certainly not a place of doom and gloom.
Denise Mulligan is manager of St. Michael's Hospice in Hastings, England, and she believes it's high time to discard the typical doom and gloom image of a hospice. The commitment of Denise and the other staff to the patients at the hospice shines through when they speak, and she's quick to point out the rewards and privileges involved in their job.
I think here those of us that work here and dearly love our hospice actually have learnt much from our patients, and we support them and they totally enrich our lives. I think when a person is actually nearing the end of their life that we can actually learn much for the way that people actually live, and I think for us that work in palliative care, we learn something every day from the people that we care for.
With many people automatically equating terminal illnesses with dreadful physical pain, it's not surprising that many patients who first come to any hospice are worried about the agonies they believe must lie in store for them. Maxine Clist is manager of St. Augustine's Nursing Home, which is attached to St. Michael's Hospice. And she says they do everything possible to ensure that dying is pain-free in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. That is what we're here for. It's not just about their physical pain, it's about their emotional pain as well. And we aim through our multidisciplinary to achieve that for them in the way that they want. They're only going to die once. Our job is to make that as peaceful and as dignified for them as possible. And it's about them allowing them to die the way they want to do.
Denise agrees with Maxine and points out that the quality of palliative care has made enormous strides in recent years.
Certainly palliative care, true palliative care, which is what we offer here at St. Michael's Hospice, specialist palliative care, is a very exacting science. You know, diamorphine is certainly one type of analgesia for physical pain, copes particularly with, say, organ pain, but you might get bone pain or nerve pain particularly, which other types of treatment are much more effective. So it's actually that really specialist approach that we offer here at the hospice that offers the best solution.
In addition to removing the pain, Maxine says their motto is to do everything within their power to make their patients' final days as happy as possible. And she told me sometimes they go to incredible lengths to try to satisfy their patients' wishes.
I had a patient who was a breeder of llamas, and her wish was to actually see her llamas before she died. And so we made every arrangement. We got drivers, we got horse boxers, and our only failing at the time was unfortunately due to the foot and mouth restrictions. We weren't able to actually get the llama down. We tried everything possible, and that was enough for her. She knew that we weren't giving up on her wishes.
Even without pain, death is a frightening prospect for most of us. So how much of a comfort is it to have a strong faith in God? The Reverend Robert Langdon is the resident chaplain at St. Michael's Hospice.
Well, my experience is that where people have a faith, it is enormously strengthening and comforting for them. But a large number of people don't have a faith, and that's where we come in. We're there for them. We seek to offer a ministry of love, compassion, sympathy, and hope. And of course, in a large hospice, such gifts are constantly needed.
He says often the real challenge is persuading people to come to terms with and accept the fact that death is inevitable for all of us.
Anthony was a depressed and agitated man, kept asking, what's it all about? What's the purpose of it all? Why? But a gentle, caring ministry of our whole team, in the end, brought about a peace and a calm and an acceptance. And I noticed that anxiety and fear disappeared from his face during those last days, and he died a peaceful death.
Maxine says emotional pain is sometimes the toughest nut of all to crack when trying to help people come to terms with their own mortality.
We've had some very tough cases. Probably the hardest ones are the ones with emotional pain. I had a gentleman who was a squadron leader in the Second World War, and he saw his whole squadron of young men burnt to death on a raid. And this haunted him all the way through his life. And this came back to him time and time again as a dream. He would be climbing steps, and when the door opened, there would be a big, large fire there that he had to step into. And this was representing what his death was going to be for him. With very, very gentle work through all members of the team, we helped him to come to terms. And I got a call in the middle of the night, and I came in and I went into his room, and his face was just so different. And he then described to me the dream that he had had that night. He climbed up the stairs and he opened the door, and instead of there being fire there, there was a big, beautiful blue sky. And he now knew that death was something that was going to be peaceful and it wasn't going to hurt. And in actual fact, Ian died 2 days afterwards, taking no more painkillers than paracetamol, because his emotional pain had gone now.
But is it tough for them emotionally, looking after people who they know are destined not to be around for much longer? Maxine again.
It can be, but as a team, we work together as a team. We all recognise that there's going to be a patient that's going to push a button in us more than anyone else. And so as a team, we rally together, we support each other. But it's not all darkness, because we have those patients alongside the ones who have got problems who are playing rock and roll music to 4 in the morning, you know, celebrating their life. And so we're part of that. So there is this balance going on all the time with happiness and sadness. But at the end of the day, if our patients have died peacefully, with dignity and with acceptance, then the stress isn't there because we've done our bit.
Do you consider that those are the rewards of your job, or are there other ones as well?
I think the reward for me is knowing that a patient has died, accepting that death is there, that they are embracing it, that they are pain-free, they're symptom-free, and more importantly, that the family are there as well, that they have accepted that this is going to happen, that we can't change the inevitable. Yes, there will be sadness, but if we can help reduce that for them by a degree of acceptance and through lots and lots of love in our community, that's where my satisfaction comes from.
That was Maxine Clist, and you also heard the voices of the Reverend Robert Langdon and Denise Mulligan, all from St. Augustine's Hospice in Hastings, England. And that's all from the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.